This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Problem of Susan, Wayward Girls in Fantasy Fiction.
So, I'm not going to lie, when Jules suggested this episode, she started with the title, and I laughed for about 5 minutes just at the problem with Susan, which for some reason was so inexplicably funny to me until I read on and I understood exactly where Jules was going with, and that this wasn't just a very personal episode that Jules put forward a problem she had with a woman named Susan, who I was up until this point unaware of.
I don't think I actually know anyone called Susan. Okay, yeah. Obviously, the title comes from the Neil Gaiman story, whereby he's looking at Susan Pevensey, the character from Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, etc., etc., who, yeah, as we'll go into later, is barred return entry to Narnia in the last book for various reasons, which again we'll go into. I don't know if you've ever read the story. It's very, very weird. It's explicitly sexual, and there's kind of a bestiality thing going on in it as well. It's Neil Gaiman, so, you know, it can be a bit of a toss-up as it's going to be good weird or weird that makes you go, what? admittedly, when I read the story, I was kind of like, what? But I do see what he was getting at, and it's been something that's been playing on my mind, and I was literally driving home, I think, yesterday, and it suddenly all crystallised into this, wow, kind of, what happens to these children in children's fiction who get spirited off to other worlds, and then they either spend the entire time desperately trying to get home, or they're quite happy there, and then the land just, like, throws them out, regurgitates them back into their normal lives. And it's never really explored, particularly in the older versions of this sort of story. What happens to them? What's, you know, has there been any change to them as people? How do they feel about having to go from this amazing fantasy land to something that was probably a bit dull and beige? And anyway, we'll explore it as we go in. But that's kind of where I was coming from.
Yeah. And actually, weirdly enough, I really do get behind you there, because it's something that always bothered me when I was reading, or that even when I would imagine these amazing worlds. And you have that weird sensation of the one side saying, okay, but I'd really miss my family, you know, I'd miss my friends, and then on the other side going, but in this world I ride a dragon, and I am the great prophet, and they hail me as queen. So on the one side, there's a very strong urge to stay. On the other side, it's that, yeah, but okay, I miss my family. And when you have the stories which just end, and then they went back and everything was normal, and I'm like,
I don't believe that.
God, I can't believe that for a second, because I just don't think that kind of, I mean, the closest we can sort of get to it by, you know, looking at it now, is we say people who maybe in combative situations, it's not exactly the same, it's different, but people who go out to war and who've been fighting war, or people who've been undercover or something like that, for long periods of time, they've accustomed to this new form of life. It's high tension. It's quite violent. They've had to compromise parts of themselves. They've had to change and adapt in order to survive. And then they go back to their normal life and they can't adjust. And it's not really a happily ever after. It's a difficult time, because their identity has been changed and they are not the person they were when they first started. And actually, maybe how can you then expect them to go back to the life of that person when it's not them anymore?
Definitely. It's a wobbly piece of narrative in the fact that children go off to a fantasy world and have dangerous and fantastic adventures, and suddenly they're put in positions where they have agency and power and they're forced to make decisions that could affect more than just themselves. I mean, all the things that you wouldn't expect. Young children generally don't have an awful lot of power, so you wouldn't expect them to do that in real life. So for them to then be either so fully invested in getting home, because let's assume the fantasy land is wonderful with a bit of, with a side of terror kind of thing. It's not like yeah. it's just terror. You haven't suddenly ended up in Mordor or something.
Yeah.
It's like, Mordor, I want to go home. Well, yeah, I don't blame you there, Sonny.
Yeah. That's fine. Everyone in Mordor also wants to go home.
But, okay, as a child, reading the Chronicles of Narnia books, that I was kind of like, okay, so you're in a fantasy land and there are a few bad things, but the animals speak and there are other gods than the Christian god and they all have feasts and things and the children don't have to go to school. And I was kind of like, why are they trying to get home? Why are they trying to get home to Second World War Britain? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But obviously they weren't really trying to get home in the Chronicles of Narnia. That was the big thing. Anyway, we'll come on to examples in a minute, but we're just sort of looking at the structure at the moment. So it doesn't make sense, in my opinion, for them to try and get, you know, okay, it's kind of like, well, I should be with my parents or I should be with my family. And in that instance, yeah, okay, I kind of get it. But on the other hand, I'm kind of like, I'm still with you, Madeline, on the sort of, yeah, but here I get to ride a dragon.
Yeah.
'Cause if I can't get home, it's kind of like, eh, is it really that much of a tragedy? It's a weird onus to put on a child character and something in the sense of, oh, you know, my parents will be devastated, they won't know what happened to me, etc., etc., when in nearly all these examples that we're going to go into in a minute, they had no choice. They were just literally sort of sucked through a portal, you know. It wasn't them messing around or anything. They just randomly ended up somewhere else. So yeah. to then have them sort of, you're responsible for getting back to the normal world. See, that's the message I think that bothers me. And it's something that Diana Wynne Jones brought up in her book of essays, Reflections. She said she had dreadful trouble getting a lot of her fantasy fiction published initially because there was a big push during the late 70s, early 80s, and, you know, slightly after, whereby they wanted children to read books about the lives they were living. And there was even a huge suggestion amongst publishers and educators and librarians at the time that said that children who read too much fantasy would become mentally ill.
Yes.
Which is bad. And obviously we know that that's bullshit because fantasy is one of the best ways to disengage from a problem and find a new perspective on it and a new way of dealing with a problem by engaging with the struggles of the character in a fantasy fiction setting. So
yeah,
so it was obviously crap. And I think that's kind of what bothers me about some of these older variants of the parallel worlds type story, is the fact that the onus is on the kids to get back, so they're already being given responsibility for something they probably shouldn't be. And then on top of that, what you're saying is there's this wonderful fantasy land out there and it's your job to reject it.
Yeah. And it also, the thing is, it actually goes against everything that we are as human beings sort of pushed and structured towards in our society, which is that we are told from a young age, kids grow up, they leave home. They leave home, their adventures, they leave their family behind. That's what they do. But that narrative has been very, in particular, pushed toward boys. Whereas girls, it's this weird mixture of saying you leave home, but then you come back. Girls stay home. Girls stay close. Boys get to go out on adventures. And it's actually sort of funny because that's a very recent phenomenon when you look at it kind of the other way around, which is that actually in the past, the son would probably have stayed home and he would have inherited the home and his new wife would have come and lived with him in the home. Whereas the daughter would have been the one who was married and would have gone away to live with her husband.
Yeah, exactly.
So she would have been the one leaving. And then the narrative switched around of girls being the caregivers. And it was, oh, if girls didn't marry, then yeah, they stayed at home and they took care and they became spinsters or whatever. But there is still, regardless, this narrative which is pushed on people within our century, which is that you go forth into life and you leave your family behind, you will outlive your family. That's what we're told. That's kind of what we're prepared for from a young age.
Yeah.
Because that is the natural order of things. And then to turn around basically and say, no, your responsibility now is to return to your family, not to follow the destiny, not to follow the adventure which you've been put on, but to actually return to your family. And then what? In a few years' time, you are then going to have to leave your family again to a life which is much more mundane, much more difficult than the one perhaps that you've chosen now or that you're part of now.
And I think that's what bothers me about it, because girls, particularly in these narratives, are the ones who get really shortchanged. The boys come back and the onus on them is not to fit in so much. It's okay to be, to, you know, take the professor from the magician's nephew. It's okay to become a rich and eccentric professor, for example. Mm. But the girls are expected to come back and either live quietly or find a suitable husband. And yeah, it is kind of the narrative that gets sold to girls so much all through our lives, you know, pretty much almost like prenatally. You're a girl, therefore you must not want too much. It's not for you. You yeah. must not want it. And it is the same with these fantasy narratives. It's a case of, it's really noticeable that it's the girls who, you know, well, you've had a wonderful adventure, now you must go back to life as it is.
Yeah. And it's also very interesting because a lot of these stories are set within a kind of a previous period where the opportunities for women back in their normal life was fairly limited. It wasn't as exciting. They certainly couldn't be queens or warriors or strategists or anything like that. Their opportunities were quite limited, whereas boys still had more opportunity for education, to vote even, you know, to be engaged with the world, to go travelling, and they couldn't actually do that. The girls just couldn't do that. So it's not just that now you have to go back to your normal life. Now you have to go back to your normal life, and it's going to get worse for you, basically.
Yeah.
And that's your lot, and that, not just that, but that's what you should be striving toward.
Yes, and choice is a big component in that as well. You may not have had any choice about being abducted by this other land, and you possibly didn't have any choice about it then rejecting you. And that's quite damaging, I think. So you've already got this narrative of you mustn't want too much, this isn't for you, and you ought to be trying to go back to normalcy. You should be rejecting the fantastical. You should be rejecting anything that's too rich. And then add to that the fact that, yes, your place is going to be a lot more limited. Your options are going to be narrower as a girl or whatever. But before that, you might well have been a queen in this fantasy land, and you may have had power and agency, but now we expect you to be contented with a very, very sort of crescent moon existence. So that's quite upsetting in the first place. The fundamental change of character, because if that was me, I would be really bloody bitter about it.
Yeah. And actually, this is something else, which is that sometimes it's, yeah, we now expect you to go back to normal life. But sometimes it's also, now we don't expect you to go back to normal life. We expect you to wait.
Yeah.
So you've been thrown out, and this is what happens with Susan, is that she's thrown out. She's told you're now too old to be able to return to this fantasy world.
Yeah.
To Narnia. So she's told she's not going to be able to return. And then she's punished for moving on with her life and putting it behind her.
Yes. I mean, reading between the lines, her attitude seems to be kind of, right, well, that's twice you've thrown me out of this place, and the last time you told me I couldn't ever go back. Guess what? I'm not a toy, so I'm going to make the best life I possibly can with the one I've got here. I don't want to be involved in any of the rest of it. I want to grow up and be a person here and actually have some agency. And I can completely understand that. But instead of it, she loses her entire family in a train crash and is the only one left behind. And the message is, well, we're denying you a sight of heaven because you want to wear lipstick and have sex.
Yeah. How dare she?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an incredibly difficult one. And for me, it was that, and it was Peter Pan always really upset me.
Yeah, Peter Pan, in a lot of ways. That is an issue, because Peter Pan obviously starts off with Wendy being told she's too old to be in the nursery anymore. It's time that she grew up. And Wendy's not ready to leave the nursery yet. She wants to stay with her brothers. She enjoys playing games with them. She doesn't want to go to be thrust into being a young woman before she's ready to be. And obviously Peter Pan turns up looking for his shadow, as you do. Mm-hmm. Wendy sews it back on for him, and Peter takes her and her two brothers away to Neverland. And that's where the adventure begins. But again, Wendy is once more thrust into a role she doesn't really want, because as a very young girl, she's not ready to be mother to sort of like 20 odd lost boys. And that's what she's told she's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Added to the fact she's the token girl in that narrative.
She is. And she has to be the mother. And she was already naturally quite responsible, but she wanted to have that freedom and that liberty.
Yeah.
And it away from her again. And to be honest, I can kind of understand why she'd then say, actually, I think I'd rather just go home. Because honestly,
why are my mother to like 20 boys? I've never even had a husband.
Yeah.
And it is noticeable in the book, the boys go out and they'll play various games, some of them which are considered which are very racially inappropriate these days, but they would go out and play, and Wendy was always left behind to keep the house. Plus Tinkerbell tries to murder her on several occasions.
The female jealousy is another issue that
there's
comes
that. And then there's this, you know, Tiger Lily is actually a character in the book as well. I'm mostly going from the book, but the Disney film was fairly close to it, and you know, Tiger Lily gets to be a bit more exciting and, dare I say the word, exotic. And Wendy once again is shoved off with the schools to get firewood. It's not a case of, well, this is a wonderful fantasy land. Well, yes, it is. But once again, you're there and you're being told it's not for you because you're a girl. And therefore, you get to be mother. You don't get to join in the games.
Yeah, you get to see it, but you don't get to participate. Which is incredibly sad. And then she goes back. And it always got me, she goes back and she kind of takes all the boys with her because they need to grow up.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a reward for them because the thing that they want, the thing that they've lacked, is a mother and a level of responsibility.
Yeah.
And there was a sequel, obviously, which is Wendy's Daughter.
Yes. I never read that one.
No. And then there was Hook as well, the film, which was a fantastic sequel about the idea of Peter. Well, because
that was excellent because it deconstructed the relationship between children and adults and the fact that as an adult you kind of lose the fundamental perspective of a child, and that stops you being able to relate to them if you're not careful.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that, it's that one, it, again, it's sad because they do head home. They go back home again.
Yeah.
But there's still this sense of they've never really left.
I think that sort of comes across in Hook really well, particularly when you've got, there's just one scene where it's, what's her surname? Maggie Smith.
Yeah,
is saying no, don't wake her to Peter. She's talking about her great granddaughter in the bed. So don't wake her because she won't understand that she can't keep you. She won't understand that she can't stay in this fantasy land. That it's not for her forever.
Yeah,
and that's always really struck me, and it took me a long time to realise why, and sort of understand that. Yeah, okay, the original Wendy's kind of made her peace with everything, and she's gone on, and she's sort of fostered all these boys and she's found all the other lost boys in the world kind of thing that she can reach and help. So she's done something worthwhile with her life. But she's done it all having been basically banished and shut out from this fantasy land because it's a state of arrested development and it won't let you stay. And it's not really for you if you're a girl.
No. And I think the other thing is that, to be honest, it wasn't really for any of them. It was for Peter. Right?
Yes.
But Peter is pretty much the only one. Peter is the power behind that. He's like some chaotic god, to be honest.
See, weirdly, even as a child, before I even knew the term psychopath, Peter kind of read to me like a psychopath.
He's kind of terrifying, and you know, there are sort of rules, and you know, you could say whether he kills the Lost Boys or whether he just flings them out. But it's interesting because it's a little bit different from Narnia. In Narnia, the children do grow up. They can develop. They can change. They have lives. Whereas with Peter Pan, it's kind of a dream. And they are just in status. They are just playing. And it's kind of about that moment, you know, that time in childhood, which you can't stay in. And you know they can't stay in because they do grow up and they do disappear. And actually, at the end of the day, it's not sustainable. And so it's a different kind of narrative and it's a different kind of message. And the only one who can really stay in that world is Peter. He's the only one because he doesn't age, because he doesn't change. And in that way, he's very, and I'm going to say it, he's very fey, okay? He's caught in time and he's trying to bring humans into that, but they just don't operate on the same line as him at all.
Yeah, and you touched on something that is important there, obviously, obviously all of it was important, but particularly with the Narnia issue, the girls grow up. They become young women. Susan in The Horse and His Boy is on the verge of deciding whether she's going to marry a Calamon prince or not.
Yeah.
And, you know, her hand is sought after by all the foreign princes. And they've been ruling for some time. You know, they if they remembered their life, it was only as one remembers a dream one had once.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then suddenly they're back through the wardrobe and they're thrust back into these children's bodies again. So how much does that mess with your head? You've grown up, you've had all these very adult experiences of the world, and then suddenly you're back to being a child again, presumably with those memories intact because they remember their time in Narnia.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm getting at with the whole sort of the characters being fundamentally changed by their experiences. I mean, you'd expect somebody who'd gone through something like that to have PTSD, wouldn't you?
You would. And weirdly enough, I feel like the recent films sort of did address it a little bit in a way that the books didn't, in that the films kind of recognize actually this must have been difficult. And one thing that always strikes me is that you have Edmund who's running off to join the war at the beginning of the second one, and him turning around and saying, you know, I was a king. We rallied armies. He's trying to have as meaningful an impact in his world as he did in the other one. He wants the same level of respect, but it's not just that he thinks he deserves that same level of respect. He wants to engage with what is happening. And he also can't seem to understand that just because, and obviously there was a lot of this going on anyway, but just because he's in the body of a 16-year-old boy, or a bit younger, he doesn't understand why he can't engage with these things, because he did when he was younger than that, and also, you know, as a king, he was a man, he was an adult, and now he's a boy again, and very confusing for him.
He's already proved that he was worthy of that as well. They all were worthy of the fact that they were, you know, kings and queens and ruled an entire land for years. So then suddenly being thrust back into being powerless in this grey sort of World War II land where the children were kind of seen and not heard, and they certainly weren't listened to, and girls even less so. And obviously you've got, as you said, Edmund running off to join the war because he wants to make a difference. The girls can't even do that.
No, they can't.
So, I love the Chronicles of Narnia. I grew up with them, and there is lots of good stuff there. And the fact that C.S. Lewis himself obviously had a oh god moment as he was coming to the end of writing The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which is the first book he wrote, suddenly sort of must have thought, hang on a minute, this is going to be an amazing problem, in the sense of astute readers are going to go, hang on a minute, but they were grown up and they had all these experiences and everything was bad. How do we address the fact that I don't really want them to have changed as characters, because, you know, yeah, in the books they haven't really that much, and they're back to being children again. So he has the professor caution them not to talk to other people about it, and not to talk about it too much even amongst themselves. And what that smacks of to me is, don't let yourself dwell in fantasy. You might find your way back there again, but you shouldn't be looking for it.
Yeah.
And it's weak. It is so unbelievably weak as an explanation.
Yeah. But I can, it's also, I also feel like it's, that's something exactly like, okay, you've had this amazing experience. He had this amazing experience and then could never get back. So he's like, you might just be better off not trying to look for it again. You're just going to have your hearts broken a little bit.
Yeah. See, the ironic thing is he theoretically could, because he knew where the rings were that took him to the wood between worlds. But he'd promised Aslan that he would never return. But theoretically, he could have popped back any time he wanted.
I'm much, much more interested now in the narratives which introduce young girls to these amazing fantasy worlds. And rather than saying, now you've got to go back to your family, find a way to actually merge the two worlds together instead.
I think
it's a much healthier idea.
Yeah, I'm totally for that. Before we really look at those, can we just have a quick look at the wonderful Wizard of Oz?
Yes, yes. Okay, let's talk about Dorothy.
Dorothy is interesting in as a character. Obviously, it's not her fault she ends up in Oz. The tornado picks the house up and delivers her there, where she sort of enacts a chosen one trope without really meaning to. And she has a lot of agency, there. She chooses what she does, and they face lots of different dangers, and she's quite accepting of the people she meets on the way, so she ends up with kind of this little entourage. In that respect, she's a good character. Yeah. I've never understood why she is so desperate to get back to the poor and dusty and, you know, not particularly well off, isolated place that she came from. Why is she so keen to get back to Kansas? To her aunt and uncle. There are no other children around, not for miles. Their harvests don't do particularly well. They don't live particularly well off because they're not well off. And then there's Oz, which again, full of dangers and things, but is also like magical and bright and colourful and has all these wonderful things happening there as well.
Yeah, I think the colour in particular always strikes me because, you know, where she is at the beginning, and even in the way that they did it in the film and stuff like that, it's just grey.
Yeah. It's even described in the book that way. She lived in a grey house amongst the grey corn and the dusty grey winds kind of thing.
Yeah. I just can't understand. She's like, I want to go back to my grey, lonely existence with my two elderly relatives who are not going to be around. This sounds cruel, but you know, it's like they're not going to be around forever. They're her only companions, and then she's kind of on her own. Her prospects are not great where she is in Kansas.
No, they're really not.
Whereas in Oz, her prospects are significantly better.
Well, yeah, for one thing, okay, she's gone around murdering witches, which I don't necessarily spot, but, but, you know, she's fated as a hero. She helped crown the Scarecrow, etc., etc. And, yeah, okay, L. Frank Baum wrote more books after that. He only ever intended it to be a standalone, and then he kind of needed money, and I respect that. I really do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she goes back. I've read some of them, but not all of them, and helps find the true princess who was deposed, etc., by the wizard. You know, without getting into the whole sort of underlying toxic masculinity and misogyny that runs through those books. They are wonderful adventures, but every time Dorothy ends up back there, what does she do? She spends the entire time trying to get home again, back to Kansas. And then when she's back in Kansas, she kind of spends the time sort of, I want to talk about my friends, the Scarecrow and the Cowardly Lion, and everybody thinks she's nuts.
Yeah, of course.
I think the Disney film, which actually genuinely kind of freaked me out a bit as a kid, Return to Oz, which has Firouzza Balk in it, was genuinely kind of scary, but did look at that whole sort of, you've been to a fantasy land, you must be mentally ill thing. You're not sleeping, you're not really helping on the farm anymore because you haven't slept at night because you're you're dreaming about these adventures that you supposedly have that no one believes in. Mm. And yeah, her aunt takes her off to an asylum with where you've got that doctor who is experimenting on people with his mad machines. So that's very disturbing.
That is incredibly disturbing.
Before you even get to the bit with the severed heads, you know.
Of course.
The whole head swapping thing is kind of creepy. I found it creepy anyway.
Speaking of asylums, there's a strong association with Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting one as well. Obviously, Lewis Carroll was writing satire, but I always found the ending as a kind of a fantasy type thing that was built for children, even though that's not really what it was, quite unsatisfying, because Alice says, oh no, you're nothing but a pack of cards, and wakes up and realises it's leaves that have been falling on her, not cards. So she denies the fantasy herself. And obviously there's other books and things. What's really interesting to me, and Wonderland is not a place where you really want to go. It's not great.
It's actually kind of scary.
It's terrifying. But so many people have retold it or done graphic novels and things, and Alice, and games as well, and Alice is kind of depicted as being mad, as being mentally ill.
Yeah.
Because people cannot believe that this place exists. It's fundamentally altered her and made her mentally unstable, is the received narrative, even though that doesn't come into the books at all.
Yeah.
And I suppose what interests me is that Lewis Carroll quite probably had the same type of epilepsy I suffer from. And if that's not medicated, that makes you very, very weird. I mean, I'm pretty weird anyway, but it makes you very strange. Because it literally alters your perception of reality and your ability to engage with it in the same way that other people do. Because normal for you is not what's normal for everybody else. And I think that perhaps that fed into his work, and back in 1865 when they were written, that would have been perceived as a form of madness, understandably. I mean, we were shutting up epileptics in asylums until sort of the 1940s, 1950s over here.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise that people would have gone, okay, you are nuts based on what you've just written.
Yeah, absolutely. Interestingly enough, the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland movie.
Yeah.
I actually preferred that ending. I mean, the ups and downs in all of the in the adaptation, but I liked that ending because it did show that she returns from Wonderland, and she really well that it was real.
Yeah.
That it was very different, and that she occupied a certain position of power there, and that she had a level of agency which was kind of being robbed from her in her real life, because she was kind of being pushed into all this marriage, which she was just going to sort of expected to do. Yeah. And instead it ends with her saying, nope, that's not for me, and it finishes with her getting on a ship to go on an expedition to go and explore.
Yeah,
and I really, really liked that, because I thought, yes, this is actually a character who has walked away from this experience and said, I know what I want to do. Even if it's this world, I am going to look for an adventure. And in particular, because Wonderland is a mess, she's probably actually going to have more fun going out and exploring different parts of the world instead.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I liked that adaptation too. Obviously, in the books, Alice is actually 7 years old, which was no accident. Seven is supposedly the age of reason when you start thinking in a way that is sort of the precursor to gradually becoming an adult, where you start reasoning your way through and making inductions and deductions without lots of guidance from parents, etc. But if you read Alice in the book, she doesn't sound like a seven-year-old girl at all. She's clearly just a mouthpiece for the author.
Yeah, and in the adaptation, it starts with the fact that she has been visiting Wonderland, or she's been dreaming about Wonderland as a child.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of been dismissed, and she's been sort of trained to dismiss it as well, as just this fantasy, as this dream, as this kind of madness. So she disengages with it, and she just tries to get on with her normal life, but she feels that something's missing, and she's not happy. And then she returns to it. And I did like that, because actually, at the end of the day, that was missing wasn't necessarily Wonderland. It was her own agency.
Yeah.
And by going to Wonderland, she got it back. And so I really did like that. And her trying to return to the normal world wasn't, God, I've got to get back to my family. Or, you know, she wanted to get back to her mother as well. She does care about her mother. But it's actually, I've got to get back to my life. I'm here to sort out your problems. But now I'm going to go sort out my problem. And my problems aren't sorted out by being here. I've got a life that I want to go and lead. So I did enjoy that. I haven't seen the sequel, so I don't know how that is then changed. But I really did enjoy that. I also want to mention earlier, you know, I made that comment about I much prefer this trend now of little girls going out, finding adventure, and then not having to just leave that adventure behind in order to meet certain conditions.
Yeah.
And I actually read a series of children's books when I was younger called Emily Windsnap.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Emily Windsnap is a half mermaid.
Yeah.
Her father was a mermaid, her mother was human, and she discovers she's a mermaid quite by accident by going into the sea, and she transforms. And up until this point, she's never been allowed to get into deep water. She's never had anything more than a shower.
Yeah.
They live on a boat, on a kind of a canal boat or something like that. But she's never been in. And I think it's they've been brainwashed. What's happened is basically mermaids are not supposed to mix with humans. So her father was imprisoned as a mermaid, and her mother and Emily have been brainwashed into thinking into having this. Her mother's been brainwashed into having this deep-rooted fear of water and the deep, and not letting her child into it. But she's still naturally drawn to the water regardless. And Emily's very naturally drawn to the water. And what happens is that, she discovers that she has this heritage, and she goes on this amazing adventure. And she's then being sort of divided between these two worlds. I don't want to really, spoil anything. The first book is quite, there's several books in the series, so you could, you are not going to lose out too much if I say how it's sort of the direction of the ending of the last one is that she doesn't have to choose between, I could have this adventure or I could just have my normal life. She gets to have the adventure, and she gets to have her mother still with her.
Yeah.
And she gets to have her family, and she gets to have her friends. And she goes out on this new adventure, and she's celebrated for that. And I really, that made me feel really warm, because when I was little, I felt like we were going in this direction of, all right, now she's going to say, well, I guess I can sort of go in and become a mermaid and splash around a little bit when I want to have fun, but I'm never going to be really engaged with this whole part of my culture and identity.
Yeah.
And I think, on one level, that stirred me on the, that bad thing of saying girls can have an adventure, but they shouldn't seek it, and then ultimately they have to go home. But also it was about saying that is another part of your identity. You know, you go to, you discover this culture of being a mermaid. And it engages a part of you, which is, part of your core.
Yeah.
And then that part of you is no longer relevant. You just cut that part out. You are not allowed to engage with it. You can taste it, but you can't live it. And that saddens me incredibly. Possibly both as a girl and saying, okay, I want to go out and have my adventures, but also, as someone who's a binational person who's kind of struggled to say, where do I belong in this? And people governing and saying, no, you can't share in this experience because you're not fully part of it. You do not meet the criteria.
Yeah.
So you can look in through the window, but you can't actually have this adventure. You can't have this story. You can't have this narrative. You don't really belong anywhere. Your path is predestined in one particular direction, which we have chosen. And I just think we need to walk away from that. So I'm really hoping to see more of that, and actually to see books which look at the consequences of being thrown out after a very large magical experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A good series of books that are quite recent is the Wayward Children series by Shannon Maguire. And they are, it's adult fiction, and they're little novellas. But each one deals with a different type of experience, sort of diversity-wise. So I highly recommend them. And basically, the Wayward Children series, there's a home for wayward children, for children who, have, through whatever reason, have fallen between the cracks, between worlds, and ended up somewhere they shouldn't, and then come back. And this home takes them in and helps them process the experience. Which I think is a fantastic idea.
That is a fantastic idea.
So instead of sort of like, no, you must repress it. No, we're going to get medicated out of you. Or we're going to shut you in an asylum. Or we're going to make sure you form a decent marriage or whatever. It's a case of, we're going to look at the experience with you and see what you can take away from it. Because you probably can't ever go back now. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you didn't learn anything of value. And they're just really, really great novellas. So I highly recommend it. It's Down Amongst the Sticks and Bones, Beneath the Sugar Sky, and there's two others. They're just really, really good. And they sort of take sort of fairy tale nursery rhyme-esque characters, and the diversity representation is really good. There's like an asexual character, there's disabled characters, etc., etc. And, you know, I highly recommend them. They're just really good. They're exactly what I want from this sort of adventure.
Weirdly enough, I do actually play into this trope. I say play into this trope. I do actually touch on this in Kestrel. I've just realised. Talking about it, I'm like, oh wait, I do actually do this in Kestrel. In the way that Kestrel, the main character, right at the start, was part of this big magical world. And then quite without choice, it's just taken away from her.
Yeah.
And then she's kind of left to just... Actually, and she has two decisions there, in that she can keep hoping that she'll be able to go back, or she can just try and say, right, I'm going to cut all of it away.
Do a Susan, basically.
To do a Susan. And she basically realises that this hope she's having that she might one day be able to get her magic back, that she might be able to engage with this magical world again, starts to kill her, getting steadily more depressed.
Yeah.
Because nothing is working for her, and she's trying and no one can help her. And they keep saying, oh, of course, you're still part of this world. You're still part of this community. But she's saying, but I'm not. I can't work now in this job. I can't see. I can't engage with it in the same way that I could. I will never be able to live in the same way that I could with it. And she eventually just goes... She finds herself in a position where she's saying, why am I even alive at all? At which point she goes, okay, enough. I can't sit hoping for me to go back. I've been told, I can't go back. So I'm going to now fling myself in so strongly in the opposite direction that the idea of magic now offends me. So I'm saying, are you sure you don't want... No, I absolutely don't. To her horror, what happens is, having made this decision, the magical world comes swinging back in and says, hey, time to go on an adventure. And she's sort of dragged into it.
There's obviously, as you said, I like with the Emily Winsnap books, which I've never read. They came along a bit late for me, but we do have them in the library. So I've seen them many times and recommended them to people. So the idea of the two worlds sort of being allowed to draw on both parts of your identity is great. There is also one where the fantasy world becomes your identity, and I suppose a good example of that is Louise Lawrence's, now out of print, but you know, people please keep demanding these books because they might then reprint these, they're that good, Journey Through Landor trilogy. And it's three books, obviously, because it's a trilogy. I'm tripping myself up here. Anyway, three teenagers are scooped out of this sort of urbanised area of Wales and find themselves in Llandor instead, which could almost be sort of quite Tolkien-esque in some respects. And there's a shadow over a sort of a vaguely Mordor-esque overseer who is looking to create a properly industrialised world that sort of exploits everything and provides wealth for no good reason, etc., etc. The Fell One, they call him. But the thing about Llandor is it actually pulls in the people it needs. But the children aren't, I said children, the teenagers, the three teenagers, are not ready to hear that at all. And so they get taken in overnight by an elf woman, and then they're warned that the Fell One's going to be after them because their knowledge of a modern world is going to be stuff that the Fell One wants to just basically pull out of their minds so that he can advance his own industrial revolution. So they have to make a journey to another gateway which might deliver them back to our time. And they have a horrible time of it. It's really, really bad. People die. People get tortured. They get separated. Someone gets abducted. And there are sort of... On the way, Carrie discovers that actually she has a gift for sorcery, but she would never have discovered it if she'd stayed in our world and become a hairdresser, which was the path that was laid out for her.
Yeah.
And the two boys, one of them was not considered to have much value in our world, and he was bullied a lot because he was overweight, but he actually becomes the best version of himself in Llandor because he sort of addresses why... the fact that it wasn't that he had a lack of value because he was fat or anything. It was a case of he had a lack of value because he didn't value himself, and therefore other people didn't value him either. And it sort of unpacks all of that. And he becomes one of the heroes. And the other boy, who had actually been really, really popular and had girls queuing up for him, etc., etc., finds that all the things that made him valuable in our world are things that are not valued in Llandor at all. And by the end of the trilogy, he's completely gone over to the dark side. So it's a really interesting exploration of human nature in that respect. And they never get home. They never get home at all. By the time they finish their journey, all three of them have ended up in different places. And they understand now that they're where they are supposed to be. And they've kind of reached an acceptance that they're never going to get home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in some ways that was much more satisfying as a narrative, because it's not a case of, oh, we must go home and leave this wonderful fantasy land. It's kind of like, this is a wonderful fantasy land that keeps trying to kill us. We're going to try and get home. Oh, wait a second. Actually, maybe we're worth more actually here than we would be at home. We've learned too much to ever go back, and we accept that now.
Yeah.
There you go. Possibly slightly dark for... the younger end of young adult fiction now, but
no, possibly. I don't know. I think young adult fiction can take it.
Yeah, I think they were sort of billed as middle grade early young adult fiction.
Ah, right.
This was back in the 90s, no, not the 90s, the 80s even.
Yeah.
Pre your birth, my dear.
just a little bit pre my birth. I think it's also part of this is, you know, a victim of the values of the time.
Yeah.
And also, actually, I think another thing is that we must make note of literature which is written around the war, during the time of the war.
Yeah.
Particularly by people who would have taken part in the war. And the fact that the desire there, they will have travelled somewhere, it would have been difficult. And maybe there would have been some good times, there would have been companionship and camaraderie, and they might have seen some amazing things, they might have had a laugh. But the horror of it all, you know, despite it all, despite the relationships, the things they've seen, the experiences they've had in these new lands, the desire to go home and the importance of home would have just been so sharp and prominent in their minds that it is no wonder we have these narratives that all about that, no matter what they see, they're all about going home, because actually nothing beats being home. So we do have to take that into account, and I think that that will actually contribute to a lot of it. And I think the fact that a lot of these were written by men, and they weren't thinking about actually that home for girls might not be quite as wholesome and wonderful as it was in their minds for boys, that there might be less for them to look forward to.
Yeah.
But also I think that it wasn't, the concentration was on the family and getting home to family and getting home to where people value you and love you. So I can really understand it at the time then. And I do still think that home itself is a very important theme, which you get in children's fiction. But as we're starting to move, forward in time, we are starting to get these tropes like found families as well.
Yeah.
Which actually say maybe home can travel with you, or home can be something that you find. And the goal isn't necessarily to get back to where you were, but to go forward to find something better. And I think that that is the story and the literature that we need for the time, during equally difficult parts of our lives, and with the political climate and with everything, this narrative of go forward and don't shy away from adventure, don't just fall back on expectation, is what we need now.
Yeah,
particularly definitely. For young girls.
Yeah, and you're right, obviously, Alice in Wonderland, The Wizard of Oz, Chronicles of Narnia, they're all products of the time, which is the only thing they can be. And you're right, we should be moving more towards this idea of allowing the fantasy in and not eclipsing it with the mundane, and not allowing the fantasy to eclipse the mundane either, finding a balance between the two and redefining, allowing the characters to redefine themselves and obviously what home is. And that is pretty much all we've got time for this week, except for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation.
Yes, and weirdly enough, this recommendation, this is from me, does involve being torn away from home and trying to get back home. There's a fairly legitimate reason for that, and my recommendation of the week is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which is just brilliant. I'm sure that many of our listeners will have already watched it by now. If you haven't, definitely go and check it out. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. The animation is fantastic. The characters are engaging. It's incredibly funny. The soundtrack, the visuals, the whole premise, it's really, really brilliant. And it follows Miles Morales, who becomes Spider-Man in his universe. And what happens is that accidentally, there is, the villain opens up a dimensional rift, pulls in other Spider-Men or Spider-Women or Spider-Pigs from different universes, different dimensions, all into Miles's dimension. And they've all got to get home. And Miles's dimension is no better than any of theirs. The only thing that might keep one of the characters, Gwen Stacy, is the fact that she makes friends with Miles. But if they stay, they will dissolve and die. They don't belong in that universe. So that's a fairly good reason to want to get back.
Yes.
But it doesn't fall into the trope of saying, well, but they get found agency. No, actually, they arrive. They help give Miles the push that he needs to become the Spider-Man that he has, is about to become, and then they go off. They're like passing sages. It's great. And I really, really love this movie. It's going to be a favourite, I think, for a very long time. And in a, we're very highly, you know, the environment is very highly saturated with superhero movies. This one feels different. It's got some great diversity as well, obviously, because and it celebrates black culture in America too, which it's just, I just really, really enjoyed it. So highly recommended. Go and check it out. And on that note, thanks very much for listening, guys, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.